Good evening to our audience on American Muslim 360 on Blog Talk Radio, and welcome to Talk Unchained. I am your host, Marlon Aldridge, and each Wednesday at 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, we discuss topics in politics, business, education, race relations, and much more. Today, I'm joined by a special guest and colleague, history professor Vanya Thornton Lewis. We discuss the role of HBCUs in the civil rights movement. We're talking about historically black colleges and universities. Of course, we want you to participate. The call-in number is 515-605-9891. Again, that's 515-605-9891. Press 1 to get in the queue so we can recognize your phone number if you have questions or comments. If you attended an HBCU and actively participated in the civil rights movement, we especially want to hear from you. We want to hear those interesting, courageous stories. Good evening, Professor Vanya Lewis, and welcome to our show. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. Good evening to you as well. So thank you for inviting me.
You are welcome. I'm looking forward to this episode of our show. For the benefit of our audience, please tell us a little bit about yourself.
Well, I am a professor at St. Clair, teaching in the history department. I'm a graduate of Central State University, and my knowledge comes from, this is a period that excites me because my goal was, when I started to work on looking at the role of HBCUs in the civil rights movement, was to find out why Wright State came into existence so close to Central State. And that was what sparked all of this.
Okay, that is great. Now, you're talking about right here, and of course, Wright State is in Fairborn, Ohio, and Central State is in Wilberforce, Ohio. And are you talking about the proximity of the colleges? Both of these are public institutions in the state of Ohio. Explain a little bit more about that so that our audience understands why you had an issue concerning the proximity of these two colleges.
Yes, I definitely will. Not only are they both in the state of Ohio, but they're also both in the same county. And so everything I had always heard was that it was illegal. Now, I never found out whether it really was illegal to have the two institutions that close together, but that as a student of Central State and transferred for a real brief second to Wright State, but I saw the HBCU as being underfunded of resources, and Wright State, the state just kept pouring money into it, and I just wanted to know why. I was trying to follow the money, but that was a little difficult because at the time I'm working, my master's is from Wright State. But at the time I'm working on my master's, I'm also working at Central State. So I'm trying to get my master's degree from one institution and my paycheck from another institution. And so there were a lot of roadblocks that manifested themselves.
I could definitely see a conflict of interest there, especially in terms of your employment by rocking the boat, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
So I can definitely understand that. Let's go ahead and get into our conversation. I'm always bragging about HBCUs. First of all, I'm a graduate of an HBCU myself, Morehouse College in Atlanta, Georgia. And I like to do a lot of research on HBCUs in particular, and I haven't posted it yet, but I wanted to look at the leadership in Dayton, Ohio, and I wanted to correspond that leadership with HBCUs. And for the most part, most, over 70% of the leadership, I'm talking about the elected leadership in this particular area, are graduates from HBCUs, Wilberforce University and Central State University in particular. I'm still trying to compile some information there. I wanted to be very thorough with establishing where these people actually went to school at. So that's I want to shore that up before I publish my findings of that. But for sure, you can be certain that HBCUs have always provided the bulk of leadership for our communities. And I'm going to talk a little bit later, hopefully if we have time in the show. As a matter of fact, I'm going to make it a question to you concerning the mission statements of these HBCUs and how important is that in addition to the curriculum and the experience that these HBCUs provide. How important is it for leadership to be included in the mission statements of these institutions? But we'll save that for a little bit later. Let's go ahead and get into our discussion tonight. How important were historically black colleges and universities in the advancement of the civil rights movement?
Oh, they were vitally important. But I have to add really quickly that it wasn't only the HBCUs, but it was also black students that were at the predominantly white institutions. The students breathed life into what was becoming a stagnant civil rights movement. And, you know, Ella Baker said that, and I'm paraphrasing here, something to the effect of that the movement needed the wisdom of the elders and the energy of the youth. And so much like today we see that what's happening with the students in Florida and them bringing life to the whole gun debate, the students from the HBCUs, and again, many from also majority institutions, breathed life into the civil rights movement. So I would argue that the movement would not have been as successful as it was, and we can talk about later about how successful that was, but it wouldn't have been as successful as it was had it not been for those four students that went into North Carolina A&T Woolworths, or North Carolina's Woolworths, and sat down. The students were from A&T. That was a spark.
That is true. That is true. Now, who, just for the benefit of our audience, who were those students? Do you remember who those students were?
Oh, my gosh. No, I do not remember their names, and I apologize because I didn't write their names down, but I do not remember their names. But you know what was What was so interesting about those four students is that they started that movement, but then they went in as paying customers to demonstrate to the management and to the employees at the Woolworths that we have money. We're not just sitting here to cause problems. We have money, and we're wanting to spend it here at the Woolworths. And so that was always something that really spoke to me when I found out, oh, they didn't just go in and sit at the counter. They said, we have money. Look, we just bought whatever. And so that was brilliant on their part to do that in that way.
That is something else. We're talking about Woolworths and Greensboro, Carolina. Ezeel Blair Jr., Franklin McCain, Joseph McNeil, and David Richmond were the gentlemen
Thank
who
you.
Participated in that sit-in at the Woolworths. And they call them lunch counters. That's I've never heard of a restaurant or a cafe being referred to as a lunch counter. So that's something new, I guess, for me to get a grip around this idea of a lunch counter. So I guess that was an important event back in the day,
yes.
is sitting
yes,
at the lunch counter as opposed to where were they, I would imagine where they were sitting at, near the restroom or,
no,
or something
they,
to that
no.
effect.
And if I may answer that, the lunch counters in the Five and Dime stores, and you're not old enough to remember the Woolworths and the Kreskies and those type of Five and Dime stores that predated the Walmarts and the Kmarts, they all had lunch counters in them that had some of the best food in the town. But they didn't serve blacks at that point in time. But that was very common for those stores to have a lunch counter.
Okay. That's something that they still have today, but don't normally sit at lunch counters. So that's something to me that was a big deal back in the day that they were actually sitting at lunch counters.
Mm-hmm.
Let's keep moving. Who were some of the great leaders of the Civil Rights Movement, and which HBCUs did they attend?
Well, we have James Farmer, who went to Wiley College in Marshall, Texas, and he goes on and gets his Master's of Divinity from Howard. So he kind of did a double there. H. Rep. Brown, who went to Southern in Louisiana. Please forgive me. Fisk had Marion Barry, the guy who goes on to become the mayor of Washington, D.C. You have Diane Nash and John Lewis, who were also at Fisk. Julian Bond was Morehouse. Jane Stomberg went to Union Theological Institute, and she became instrumental and SNCC, which we'll talk about a little later, I'm sure. So Fisk had a crop of greatness that came out of it. And those are just a few of the names.
Okay, there were many others. There were many others, but
yes.
You did name some great ones there. I'm sitting here thinking about, I'm in my 50s, but I do remember. And I think it was called, we referred to them as the Chain of Rap Brown. Does that sound familiar? Here in Dayton, growing up as a young man, I remember the Chain of Rap Brown, and they rode around on motorcycles, and they normally had shotguns. I would see them in the park. My mother would take us to the park, and I would remember being sort of fearful of these men. And here I am with my mother. I was very protective of my mother, and I don't care who you were. If you mess with my mother, I can tell you there was going to be some trouble. And I was a little skinny little boy, but I would attack you if you even attempted to touch my mother. But of course, as I grew older, I found out that they were out there protecting my mother and I. So.
Yes. Yes.
That was something, and I also remember the Black Panthers as well.
Yes.
One event I remember now, I don't know how, can't really say this was a hallmark event for them, but I remember attending Waugaman Elementary School, and there was a gang fight at lunch. The kids were out at lunch, and there was a gang fight out in the back. I guess it was about 12 gentlemen or so. They didn't have guns like they do today, but they have chains and sticks and all that, and they were back there hitting it on. I don't know if that, I know one group was the Black Panthers. I don't know who the other group was. It may have been the Chain of Rap Brown, but these young men, they were out there, they were throwing down. So that's one of the events that I remember, and that was back in the 70s. But I remember that very vividly. I remember that was a fight to behold.
It was.
Chain of Rap Brown. The Chain of Rap Brown and the Black Panthers. All right, talk to us. And here's one of the – go ahead.
No, I was going to say, may I pick up on the Black Panthers?
Go ahead.
We hear so much today about our Second Amendment right, the right to bear arms. And so Black Panthers really embraced that. And they started in Oakland to protect kids at school. It had to do with a crosswalk that was extremely dangerous. And so when they started for self-help, but they also understood what the rights of the people were supposed to be. Now, we know that a black man walking around in black leather and with black tams on their head and with rifles is going to be intimidating, but they were willing to take that risk, and that's something to be admired. They were willing
that's true.
Your Constitution tells me that I can do this.
That's true. The right to bear arms, the constitutional rights. I've been making a lot of comments on Facebook about that. Of course, I won't go into that today. The history of that is not what people think it is.
Yes.
And
you're right.
So that has morphed into something that is a construct that is totally different from what it was intended in the very beginning. Talk to us about the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, or what was referred to as SNCC. Talk to us about that, and what were some of the luminaries with that particular group?
Well, SNCC is... It really goes through some transformation in its day. Carson Claiborne, I'm pronouncing his name wrong, please forgive me, talks about that it went through three major stages in its development, that it really started with the ideas of Gandhi and King, in that it was optimistic about people doing the right thing, and that... they just had faith that confronted with an option to choose either to be purveyors of the racism that had permeated our society for so many years, or to give equality, that people would choose equality and justice. Well, they were wrong. So they quickly became disillusioned with people's responses to the civil rights movement, and so then they became much more actively involved in community and feeding the needs or fulfilling the needs of the community. That didn't really get them what they were ultimately looking for in the area of social justice and equality. And about that time, they changed leadership from John Lewis, who's still a congressman, from John Lewis to Stokely Carmichael. And Stokely Carmichael takes them in a direction that much more radical, much more militaristic, much more confrontational. And they coined the phrase Black Power, which wasn't meant as a phrase to intimidate, but was meant as a phrase to empower, because they were looking at the self-sufficiency of the black community and the empowerment of the black community to take care of itself, not to override or to take over another group, but to be self-sufficient. Ella Baker is one of the lost sheroes of the civil rights movement, who doesn't give it as much play as I think that she should, brings together students from different campuses to Shaw, again in North Carolina, a couple of months after the sit-ins at the Woolworths, to come up with, to organize this group, because she understood, again, wisdom of elders, but the energy of the youth was needed.
That's true. Now, if I'm not mistaken, she graduated from Shaw University, I think it was in 1927. So she was a little older when she came back to help organize that group in 1960. So she was definitely, don't really want to call her, well, I guess we could at that point. She would have been an elder at that point.
Yes.
Coming
absolutely.
Back to help organize the students. So what you say is very apropos in terms of the elders having linkages with the energetic young people. So that's important.
Yes.
I don't know if a lot of that is happening today, but it was definitely happening during that time period, and I think that's very important because that is a cultural artifact for us, is that our elders always provide or have always provided us at leadership, and we've sort of gotten away from that, at least in my humble opinion. I think we've gotten away from that, and there's a disconnect and a sort of like a confrontational barrier between our elders and our young people. So
yes.
That's a great compare and contrast when we look at that time period, which was definitely more confrontational than this time period, but we see that contrast, and maybe we need to get that back in order to push us forward, is that the elders and the young people need to be more connected. So that's very
yes.
interesting.
Yes.
Is there,
and I don't know. I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
I just want to say, and I don't know where it was lost at. I don't know where we lost respect for elders, and our elders lost respect for the young people. And I don't even know where to put the blame at. And I say blame, but I'm not sure which side really shoulders the responsibility for that disconnect to have happened. But you're absolutely right in it. And
let me take a guess at that.
Okay.
Let me take a guess at that, because that was one of the subjects of a couple of shows we had concerning the pros and cons of integration. And so we can imagine that many of these folks during that movement were integrated into the mainstream. And you mentioned some became politicians,
yes.
some became mayors, and I'm sure some became administrators at some of the predominantly
yes.
white institutions. And so when you go into the mainstream, you have to take on a different persona. And
yes.
we want to turn our noses up many times, it seems like, for the very people that put us in those positions, and I'm really talking about the elected officials. When you think about, they were powerless were it not for the working class folks, the lower income folks, which was the majority of us who actually put them in office. So now you get into office and you turn your backs on the very power base that puts you in office. Some of us, many of us, fail to realize that even till today is our power base. So you can be as uppity as you want if you're an elected official, but you're not going to go very far if you neglect the needs and aspirations of your power base. And that is
yes.
within the urban environments for the most part, and in these lower income and middle income, lower middle income neighborhoods. So it's very important,
yes.
I think, for us to understand that. At least from my perception and what I've heard from many of our guests on the show, is that integration can be one of the social forces that may have caused the divide that we see today between our elders and our young people. So that's just one perspective. I'm pretty sure that there are more. I wanted to bring up SNCC because there were some other civil rights organizations that people are more familiar with, and I'd like you to talk, compare and contrast the two. You've already mentioned SNCC, but I think I'm thinking let's compare and contrast them to the NAACP, the National Urban League, the Congress of Racial Equality, and SCLC. I'm going to – well, let me do this, and then you'll see where I'm coming from. I have here a book written by Manning Marable, and, of course, he's from this area. He's deceased now, and he wrote a book called Race, Reform, and Rebellion. The subtitle is The Second Reconstruction in Black America, 1945 to 1982. And I've read this book from back to cover, and he opines that the SNCC, the major force, and you sort of alluded to it, that they changed their strategy over time and became a little bit more militant. And he suggested had it not been for SNCC, we'd have been hard-pressed to get any of these gains. The other groups, what say you to that? Let me shut up and what say you to that?
I agree with that 100%. I agree with that 100% because we have the NAACP, great organization, historically a great organization, but it was trying to change the laws. And that the litigation process is a slow process. You know, when we look at Brown versus the Board of Education and the desegregation, and I heard your show last week, and I'm going to challenge the use of the word integration and say desegregation, because me sitting beside somebody of a different color doesn't mean I'm integrated with them. So, I listened to it on podcast, so I wasn't able to call in because I would have called that in last week. The Brown versus the Board of Education, which talks about desegregation of particularly the public schools, and then it's later expanded to other areas. I think it was Darlene Clark Hine that I read in one of her books talked about if the process had continued the way it was with the first Brown decision, it would have taken 7,000 years to desegregate the school system in the United States because it was so slow.
We have
places like Little Rock, Arkansas, who says instead of my child going to school with these black people, and I'm sure that wasn't the word that they used, we'll shut the schools down. So they shut the schools down for 2 years. So the NAACP's methodology, which was litigation, was much slower. The Urban League was really a product of Booker T. Washington, and so they are much more about employment, thrift, savings. So their area is not as much civil rights in getting those basic rights as it is about getting the employment. And then CORE is actually a smaller group, and its focus is in the North. And you see some of CORE, the Congress of Racial Equality, you see some in the South, but most of that is in the North. So you see them concentrating on areas like Chicago. So SNCC is much, you know, but at the same time, I understand that CORE is responsible for the freedom rights, you know, at least the first round of the freedom rights. So, you know, they challenged the South, they challenged the laws, but they were just not as powerful as SNCC. And maybe SNCC's ability to adapt itself to a changing environment, adapts itself to the changes of American society, even gave it an edge over CORE.
That's true. I have a motto that says that knowledge is power, but organization is intelligence. And that SNCC, they were highly organized. It's sort of hard to imagine young people being that highly organized. Talk to us a little bit about these Freedom Rides. Let's get an idea of what these Freedom Rides were all about.
The Freedom Rides were the federal government had passed legislation that said that interstate transportation, the buses, had to be desegregated, had to be, thinking back to the Montgomery bus boycott, where you had a rope that separated the black side from the white side, they had to be integrated. And so we have the Freedom Rides who are challenging that, who start in the north, but they're going to the south. And please forgive me because I can't remember what city they started at and where they were ending at. And I apologize to you for not being able to recall that. But when the Freedom Riders stepped onto the bus, as they were stepping on the bus driver asked them, "Are your affairs in order?" And what a sobering thought to think I'm getting ready to take a bus ride and you're asking me if my affairs are in order. Oh, I'm sorry that you were talking to me. And so what we see with the Freedom Rides is that they're testing that legislation. You know, the buses get bombed. They get drug off of buses. They get beaten in at the rest stops. And so it was a tumultuous trip for those who chose, and it was not just black students, it was black and white students who said, "We're going to test this legislation."
Okay.
And many of those places that they – go ahead.
No, go ahead.
I should say many of the places that they had the most difficulty, they were being the mobs were being led by the officers in the police force. So they had no protection. They had no protection, or little protection, I should say. And I shouldn't say no, but little protection.
Yeah, I'm seeing here one of the luminaries that, at least from Manning Marable's standpoint, that often not talked about is Bayard Rustin.
Mm-hmm.
And he was one of the people that helped to lead the Freedom Riders as well. But he is one of the few people that is not talked about in the civil rights movement. But he was one of the seminal thinkers and planners during the civil rights movement.
Yes.
Let's compare and contrast to, well, we've already mentioned that. Which HBCU campuses were most known for civil rights activities and which were lesser known?
I'd say North Carolina A&T is probably the best known. To add into that, Jackson State. In Jackson, Mississippi, I'm sorry. Howard is known for its activism. Lesser known, I would have to put at the top of the list Central State. And that.
Okay, tell us what did Central State do? What did Central State University
do?
What did they do that is worthy of note?
Sounds like you're kind of trashing my alma mater there.
I have a lot of friends there. I always joke with them about CSU, but I love CSU, though. I love HBCUs in particular.
Central is really instrumental in helping to desegregate Greene County. And, you know, it is the National Guard. The National Guard the first campus that they occupied in the state of Ohio was not Kent State. It was Central State University. And you have a disruption over a student that I'll leave nameless, but a student who is suspended and kicked off a campus. You've got their staff who is protesting and who is asking for a raise. And you've got the city of Xenia, which is had issues. It still has issues, but had issues racially. That all kind of, it's kind of the perfect storm, and that it all comes together, and that Central State had a riot in the 1960s that caused the National Guard to come out before they go to Kent State. It happened about 2 months before Kent State.
I didn't know that. But that's a new one for me. I'd never heard anybody talk about that. That's a new one.
Yeah. But Central State, you know, when you look at the city of Xenia, the city of Xenia had a segregated theater. It had a segregated lunchroom. It had a barbershop. Now, I don't really know why they would want to go to the barbershop that they were protesting in Yellow Springs, but you have a barbershop that actually, a barber, I should say, that actually locks his doors, and if somebody black is trying to get in, he won't let them in. And so it is, it's Central State students, and in some cases with the assistance of the Antioch students who are instrumental at saying, we're mad as heck, and we're not going to take it anymore. And
okay.
So, you know, Xenia had a segregated Memorial Day parade. They had a black parade that went to the black cemetery and a white parade that went to the white cemetery. And they, never the twain met would meet on those two parades. And they kind of shut that down.
Wow.
Yeah. The there's a book that came out many years ago that talked about Central State the first 100 years. And it doesn't go into any of that. And it's really a shame because it is in many ways a lost history of how vital the campus was to the desegregation and to the civil rights movement for this county.
Well, there's going to be a lot of that, I would imagine, that you don't read in the history books. Of course,
yes.
Since I attended Morehouse College, I know some stories about MLK that, you know, some people may not know. Now, of course, he was nonviolent, but there were some times where he was not nonviolent and he had to throw those
yes.
fists. And see,
yes.
you get to hear some of those stories. There was an elder there. As a matter of fact, I think he's still living till this day. And I was there in the early 80s. His name is Mukasa. I don't know what his real name is, but he used to tell us all of those stories. And so those are some of the things that you probably will not read about in the history books. We're going to take a quick station break. We're talking with Professor Vanya Thornton-Lewis, history professor at St. Clair Community College. We're discussing HBCUs and their importance in the civil rights movement. We will be right back.
There's a place where words make people, a place where you're invited to expand your heart and mind. There's a place where your intellect is respected and your voice protected. You're listening to the American Muslim 360 Radio Network, 24/7, Muslim-hosted, from religion and current world events, politics, faith and education, marriage and health, music and arts, physical fitness and more. Join AM 360, where we're helping to build a model community every day. It's a place where you can help remake the world.
We are back on American Muslim 360 on Blog Talk Radio. This is Talk Unchained, and we are discussing HBCUs and their importance in the civil rights movement with Professor Vanya Thornton Lewis. Let's see. Let's come current.
Okay.
What role can HBCUs play today? We know about their historic role. We know about their importance to our communities in terms of providing leadership. And we know that young people, we're talking about our young adults, are actively involved. We see this in terms of Black Lives Matter movement. But let's talk about HBCUs, though. Do HBCUs matter in today's society? What is your opinion about that? Do HBCUs matter in today's society?
They should. I don't know that they do as much anymore. And the reason I don't think that they do is because they used to be kind of the cities on the hill for Black students. And we couldn't go to the Harvards and the Yales and the predominantly white institutions, the Ohio States and Miami's. And so those places had to be places of excellence. It was the only hope that we had as a race to get our piece of the American dream and a piece of the American pie. Now, getting that cream of the crop, getting that, being that committed to that excellence becomes now about how do we keep our doors open. Now, that's not all HBCUs. I don't want to give the impression it's all HBCUs, but it's way too many of our HBCUs that we don't send, not you personally, we in general, don't send our children to the HBCUs. And because we don't even support our HBCUs financially, because their alumni contributions are a far smaller percentage than a predominantly white institution, they don't have as much to work with. And then I would argue, thinking about my own alma mater, they haven't always hired in the best administrators to manage what they do have. Because I discount the saying that we can do more with less. No, you can't do more with less.
I agree.
You can't do more with less. And so there, you know, one of the things, because in preparing to talk with you, I did a perusal through my thesis, and it's interesting to me because every time historically Central State was in trouble, because that was also one of the reasons for the quote-unquote riot, there was a threat by the state that says, well, we just need to merge you two together. And it wasn't Wright State then, but we need to merge these two institutions together. And still, every time there's something negative that happens or negative that comes that's in the Dayton Daily News about Central State, you start to hear people talking about, well, those three institutions either need to merge together or we need to take our state money and just put it in one institution and make this a Wright State East. And so there's always the threat of closure that is hanging over its head in modern times. I don't think that the dedication to excellence is there anymore. And I want to go back to something you said earlier about the desegregation. You know, I still have friends who teach there, and the faculty is extremely diverse, which is a good thing on one end. On the other end, I remember the SE pains that grabbed me as a student and made me. She handed me back a paper because she said that she knew I could do better. And I don't know how much of that is going on today. I'm sorry, I'm rambling. I apologize. But that excellence, I think, is missing in a lot of our HBCUs.
Yeah. There's more competition now, for sure, because the predominantly white institutions, they want some of those students as well. So they've improved their programming. And, of course, the money has always been an issue. And then, of course, when you understand that the public educational system is not doing a great job at preparing our students. But I'd still make the argument that these institutions are still vital institutions because of what they continue to produce. When you look at the small numbers, I think they're less than 3% of the higher education universe. But yet, when you look at the STEM fields, the science, technology, engineering, and mathematics, they're producing about 48, somewhere. It's a pretty high number. Don't get me to lying on the statistics.
Okay.
I have that information. But it's a pretty high number compared to the number of students that they take in and compared to, you know, the numbers that they make up in higher education as a whole. I'm thinking about professional degrees as well. Now, I know those numbers are over. I can be pretty comfortable when saying they're over about 40%. You look at the lawyers and doctors, we're producing over 40%. I'm tempted to say about 50%, but I know those numbers are high. And again, if we look at the leadership here in Dayton, most of the leadership is going to come from Central State University and Wilberforce, both HBCUs. Now, let me argue you this. I have a 10-year-old. She's going to Spelman.
Good
and she doesn't have a choice. She doesn't have a choice. I've already started her education fund, and she needs to have at least an A average to get in there, A minus to even get in there. This college doesn't play. You're talking about some of the sharpest women, that young women that you're going to see coming out of any college. So I would put that school up there with any college on the planet. And, again, they won't let anybody in there, and I'm already saving up because I know it's going to be a load. I'm thinking about HBCUs. Now, I'm just going to name some of the alumni from Morehouse, and some of these names you're going to be familiar with. Now, Samuel Jackson is graduated Morehouse. Spike Lee is a graduate Morehouse. Bill Cosby's son, who's deceased now, is a graduate or was a graduate of Morehouse. When you look at Denzel Washington, his son is a graduate of Morehouse College. Now, here's the question I like to put. These are some of the richest men in the country.
Yes.
Why are they sending their children to HBCUs? Now, Bill Cosby's daughter, one of his daughters, attended Spelman when I was there. Now, to be honest with you, I remember her smoking a whole lot of weed. And she didn't finish there. She ended up going somewhere else. But I remember his daughter being there. I think his son may have been a little younger than I was. But his daughter, one of his daughters, I think he and his wife have four children. But his daughter was there, smoked a whole lot of weed, didn't make it through. I don't know what she's doing today. But the question I always ask is, why are people with money sending their children to HBCUs? There must be something important about HBCUs for their for rich people to continue to send their children there. And again, my daughter, as far as I'm concerned, she doesn't have any choice in the matter. She's going to Spelman. One of the reasons she's going there, I was across the street at Morehouse, and I had a hard time trying to do some of the things that a young man wanted to do with young women, because the Spelman women, they were all about getting that piece of paper. So that's enough right there just to make me want to send my daughter there. I want to put that in there. The men aren't going to have a chance. Yes, the way, if all of the women are thinking from that mindset, don't come here with that bull crap. I'm here to get a degree. I'll see you when I get the piece of paper. So I want her to have that mindset as well. Well, what? Go ahead.
I'm going to throw out a couple of just observations about the list that you shared, in that it's the institutions that you shared are the cream of the crop of the HBCUs. And are they the cream of the crop? It's not a question. It's a statement. But I wonder if they're the cream of the crop because the Samuel L. Jacksons, the Bill Cosbys, send their children to those institutions. So those institutions have more to work with. It's a rhetorical question again.
I'm not sure that even people know that they attend those colleges. Now, I'll tell you, that's one of the things, and I wanted to end up with that. We're nearing the end of our show. I attended and this was just here last summer. We had a homecoming. That's what they call it, a homecoming. And I was in the NRLTC unit there, and I can tell you that Morehouse College probably produces more pilots than any black pilots, that is, than any other college that I know of, because I have a lot of friends that I went to school with that were military pilots and are now civilian pilots, in terms of flag rank officers, in terms of O6s. These are your colonels and your captains. Mm-hmm. These colleges, although small in number, and Morehouse, I don't think he has any more than a 2,000 students as a student body, but yet you're going to see them producing very high numbers of field grade officers. Mm-hmm. And so that's one of the other things that people are looking at. They're looking at not only the students that they produce, but what these students end up doing. And that's what I wanted to say. I wanted to hold till last. I did some checking, and I know that a lot of these top schools, if you look at their mission statement, they will have some mention of building or developing leaders, of developing leaders. Central State had that in their mission statement, and here they are producing many of the leaders here locally in terms of elected officials and professionals. Wilberforce, to be honest with you, is even a smaller college. They've been having some troubles here. It's a private institution. And if you look at the judges, seven times out of ten, they're going to be graduates of Wilberforce University. And Wilberforce had Floyd Flake, who was a graduate, who was a U.S. congressman. He was the president there. I noticed that during the time he was there, they had a leadership statement, aspect in their mission statement. He transitioned out. They had new people come in. They changed the mission statement. It had something to do about producing good Christians or something like this. And from there, the school went down. I don't think they have a student body of any more than 400 or 500 students there. And they've been having a lot of troubles there financially. And in addition to the people that were coming in to be the central administrators, I'm going to argue that the mission statement is very vital in what the college determines that it will do. And so many of these colleges, if you look at the HBCUs, many of them will have some aspect of leadership development in their mission statement, and the evidence is there. Most of your leadership, and I would argue that I don't care where you go in the country, if it's in a city, some metropolitan area, if there's a black person in that position as mayor or city council, that person will most likely be an HBCU grad. I know Atlanta just selected a mayor, a female there. I can't remember her name. She is a graduate. I want to say Spelman, but I'm not sure that it is Spelman. But I see a lot of that, and I make mention of that. I want to take note of that. When I see these people in those positions, I immediately want to know where they went to school at least undergrad. What expanded role do you think that HBCUs can play today?
In developing the future leaders and empowering people with their knowledge, with their history, with their sense of self. Real quickly, I have taught at Central. I went to Wright State. I would take a Central State student any day when I was there and put it against a Wright State student for critical thinking skills. Continue to develop that.
Yes, yes. Critical thinking, that is important. As a matter of fact, that's what I teach in my classes. The students come in and they think I'm teaching physics, and I tell them first day that I am teaching critical thinking and problem solving, and that physics is the context by which I will teach you those skills. I could go on and on about that. I'll say that for another show. I think that thinking people can be given opportunities to think, and that professors and instructors need to provide more of that virtuous teaching content. They need to provide opportunities for students to develop their critical thinking skills. I do think that that can be taught. And, opinion, what are the great civil rights challenges of today?
Maintaining voting rights, largely due to gerrymandering, equality in our educational system, K through 12. I think that those are the two biggest areas that we have to focus on moving forward for the black community.
That is true. I want to talk to you about this equality. I'm going to tell you something that I have been trying to do, and I had a problem with one of the ministers here. And you may have seen this post. I actually put this on Facebook.
Okay.
I had wanted to entertain the or interest in forming a black political entity here in Dayton. And here was my frame of thought. My frame of thought is that we need to come together first as a group and to determine. Well, we need to educate ourselves on the political process, and we also need to determine what it is that we want to do. What are our agendas? We need to monitor some of, and this is just me thinking, this is some of the aspects I wanted to look at. And I wanted to do it at one of the local churches, and one of the pastors, associate pastors now, didn't want to do that because it was black. Now, this was the second time I had approached the first time I had approached a preacher of the church, the pastor of the church, and he told me he didn't want anything to do that with anything black. And I was thrown aback by that. He was older. He was older than I. He was an elder. And he told me he didn't want anything to do with anything black. And I know in the scriptures it talks about people being equals in the eyes of God. And one of the things that I posted on Facebook concerning the need for us to be able to organize so that we, when we do meet with white folks, we don't look like fools and we're not sitting there, you know, scratching our heads and quoting scriptures and all of this other kinds of things that we do, you know, grinning and smiling and all of this old kind of stuff when there's no need to be doing that. We seem to want to do a lot of that, and we end up not being able to gain any traction and being overlooked, such as you see the black women, at least in the women's movement, in association with the Democratic Party, they've been disenchanted with that, because here they are putting in a lot of work, but they aren't benefiting in it. And you saw what happened in Alabama, and we just aren't getting anywhere. And that's because we aren't organized, and the fact of the matter is we're not equal. We may be equal in the eyes of God, but we're not in heaven yet. And on top of that, when we come to the table, we may have constitutional rights, just barely. They have constitutional powers, and we don't seem to get that. So I think it's very important that we organize ahead of time, plan 12 steps ahead, then go sit at the table, versus coming to the table thinking we're going to get something done, and nothing gets done because we haven't organized or planned prior to. Did you want to comment on that? Looks like we got one guest. Let me take this guest here, and then we're going to come back, and we're going to close out the show. We're speaking with Professor Vanya Lewis. Caller from 636. State your name, if you like, and where you're calling from.
Yes, Kareem Hamid, and I send the greetings of peace to you, Professor Marlin, and Professor Vanya, for an excellent broadcast this evening. I want to pose the question: what is the most critical issue that we should be addressing or is being addressed? I would like to say one of them, from what I'm hearing from across the diaspora of African-American people and also on the ground, is economic independence.
Mm-hmm.
I've seen a strong surge of entrepreneurship among us. It's one thing to come to the table, but your pockets are empty. You know what I'm saying?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, let's face it. The business of America is money. And if you do not have no investment, you are not fully vested. You are not bringing any material accomplishment with you. You are still reliant on other communities to provide your needs. And you're not providing them for yourself. You are in a very, very weak position. So I'm grateful to see our young people, our youth, they are fired up about opening up businesses and entering entrepreneurial pursuits. Thank you. What an excellent broadcast, as always. As always, Professor Marlin.
Thank you.
For the insight of your honorable guest. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Thank you for listening. Kareem from St. Louis, Missouri. Vanya, did you want to respond to that or add anything?
All I could say is that absolutely. I think that he said it very well. He said it very well. And I'm reminded of Frederick Douglass's quote that people with no demand have no power, or you concede nothing without a demand.
Power concedes nothing without a demand. Power concedes nothing without a demand. That is true.
Demand.
It takes me back to my motto. Now, I would argue that, at least among us, we say that knowledge is power. I'm going to argue that we have knowledge. We're speaking to knowledge right now. when you're on American Muslim 360, you are listening to a lot. Well, there are a lot of knowledgeable people in the audience. I can vouch for that. And then there are many of us out in our particular communities, I don't care where you go, that are very knowledgeable. So we've never lacked knowledge. What we lack is organization. So again, knowledge is power. but organization is intelligent. So we need to get organized. Mm-hmm. We need to have more organizations, not less. Let's go with one more caller. We got the phones lining up here. Caller from 404. Caller from 404. State your name if you like and where you are calling from.
Assalamu alaikum, Brother Marlon Aldridge, and to your guest, Dr. Danya. I didn't get your last name.
Danya Lewis. Danya Thornton Lewis. Wa alaikum salam.
This is Sister Amina from Decatur, Georgia. What I wanted to mention is that there's a lot of lessons that we've learned from the civil rights movement, and we had different segments of not only the human rights movement but the civil rights movement, and we had people that were not, how can I say, they were ignored. Mm-hmm. That part of their contributions was ignored, because we had Pan-Africanism, we had the other movements that were going along with the civil rights, where that affected the outcomes of a lot of what had gone on. But also, we have to realize that in that movement, we had a lot of spying that was going on by this government, COINTELPRO and all of that, the FBI and all these, the CIA and all these people that affected the outcome of these movements, and those of us that were matriculating and came of age at that time, remember, even though I was up north and I know of different people in my family and people I went to school with, you know, they were matriculating in other parts of the country, but what happened is that the civil rights movement, it came at America from all different levels. We had the human rights movement. We had the Nation of Islam. We had the Pan-Africanism. We had the civil rights marches and protests all over. But this government vowed, and it's in the documents, that we will never allow, because we almost shut the country down, literally, because of our quest for rights. But then you had people that overtook and infiltrated, and some people got payoffs at the expense of the masses, and then you have some people that have said that the women's rights movement and the gay rights movement took that over. So now that affected a lot of the outcome, but there's never was any, everybody got their rights. You know, you have the Jewish community got things, the Indian community at the expense of African Americans, and now what we have to do is affect change through our economics, and we have to look at how do we regroup, what lessons do we learn going forward, because now look at what they're doing with the Voting Rights Act and everything else when it comes to African Americans going for their rights. It's always, you know, we don't want to deal with you all. Everybody else can get it. So we have to look at economics and entrepreneurship and going forward now, because the masses of African Americans are really being affected. You know, we have some people that have the gains, but the masses of our people are hurting all over this country. You look at gentrification as one mini example. So it's been said by several activists now that you can look in the literature. They have it in the open records files that they will never allow because they couldn't deal with the fact that, you know, we came at America with all fronts. And this is why all these assassinations happened. All of that because they never want us to organize and unite again around our rights. Everybody else is right, but not ours. We have to look at that.
That's true. And I would say, I've always said, that's our greatest generation. For those of you out there in the audience who participated in that, in my mind, you are our greatest generation. Sister Amina, we're about to close out here. I thank you for being a loyal listener. Sister Amina from Decatur, Georgia. Thank you, ma'am. All right, Vanya, we're at the end of our show, and I appreciate you. Of course, I'd like to invite you back at a subject of your choosing. And to our audience, we're always looking for exciting show titles. So you can call me. You can catch me on Facebook. Give me some ideas. Even if you have guests, send them my way. I'd be happy to talk to them. We're always looking for exciting show titles. Of course, we want to inform. We want to educate. And you know me. Has to be a little bit of provocation, too. I like to provoke thinking. I love to provoke thinking. Thank you to our audience for your thoughtful questions and comments. If you would like to listen to past episodes of Talk Unchained, visit blogtalkradio.com/AmericanMuslim360 and search for Talk Unchained or Marlon Aldridge among the on-demand episodes or in the search box near the top of the webpage. We'd like you to tune in to more informative, thought-provoking broadcasts on AM 360 tomorrow morning at 7 a.m. That's Eastern Standard Time for critical issues with solutions, money sense, and a new day for El Islam. This is Marlon Aldridge with history professor Vanya Thornton Lewis. I welcome you back next Wednesday at 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Spread the word about the show and follow me on Facebook. Until next time, peace be unto you. Thank you, Professor Vanya Lewis.